This is Gil Manser. Welcome you to Word by Word Conversations with Writers, where tonight's conversation is with the award-winning mystery novelist, Rob Loughran. And he's talking about his newest novel, Tantric Zoo, where forensic anthropologist Bud Warhol's investigation of a body buried for over 20 years leads back to a 1987 couples retreat when a weekend of hedonistic sensuality ended in a death and a secret burial that has haunted the campers ever since. Rob Loughran has 13 books in print, 200-plus articles published in National Magazine, 8 children and 12 grandchildren. He's an avid runner, lives happily and quietly with wife Penny in Windsor, California. His first novel, his actually debut novel, High Stakes, won the New Mystery 4th Annual New Mystery Award-winning award. And I want to talk about the fact that your experience working in restaurants, you probably, if you've been in restaurants in Sonoma County, you probably met Rob. He's been, you know, behind the bar, somebody who's taken your order, who's introduced you when you walked in the door. He's got so much background there that he made his amateur detectives, like in High Stakes, and that's spelled S-T-E-A-K-S. Where Davis O'Kane discovers a dead body in his Nevada restaurant, and Bud Warhol is the half-owner of a bar serving pub grub, as well as an on-call forensic anthropologist for the sheriffs and police departments in Sonoma and Mendocino counties. So do you still work in restaurants at night and write during the day?
I do indeed. I work at the farmhouse in Forestville right now.
Uh-huh. And you've had, I met you, geez, it's been a dozen years ago.
Yeah.
I think way before High Stakes came out, when you were just doing short stories.
Right, exactly, yeah.
At one of the,
one of the writers' clubs.
That's right, Redwood Writers.
When it was over in Coddingtown.
Yes.
Long time ago, at least 10 years.
Yeah, when we used to have lunch because the people who wanted to drink their lunch had to have a bar. Yeah, exactly. And then at that, so you had the idea for High Stakes then, and you kind of worked through it. And
Actually, it had been completed, and I completed it around 97, and then I shopped it. And it's the old catch-22. You can't send it to many publishers unless you have an agent, and you can't get an agent unless you have a work of fiction published. So I literally sent it to every English-speaking publisher of mystery fiction in the world that accepted unagented fiction.
Right. And over the transom.
Over the transom, and it got into the slush pile, and it got rejected. So what I did is, what am I supposed to do, give up? No. So I took my cousin's name, Brad Morrison, and I created the Brad Morrison Agency. Mm-hmm. And I got a Brad Morrison email, and I started writing letters about myself in third person, pitching High Stakes to publishers who only take agented fiction. And I got much nicer rejection slips from publishers. And it's a bit of a deception, and I would have told anybody who did it. But again, what am I supposed to do, give up? The book is obviously publishable and readable. And so it finally won the award, and part of the award was getting published.
Uh-huh.
So
they read it in the draft version?
No, it's pretty much the final version that it was in right now, yeah. The only thing he did is change the name. It was called Fish Stories from the Mark Twain quote, don't tell lies where they know the fish, but most importantly, don't tell lies where they know you. And he wanted to change it to High Stakes because he didn't want the editor didn't want it to be confused as a collection of short stories.
Gotcha.
Which is a good idea, actually.
Yeah. You've actually published some other things on your own. You've done your joke books by yourself.
I have. I've done my joke books on Lulu, a print-on-demand publication. I have, I think, a series of 7 or 9 joke books in print. And my latest project is to take all my joke books, or at least the 3 that sell well, and do them on Smashwords and get them onto Moby Pocket and Kindle and Android and sell them for about $1.50 each and make pretty much the same amount of money that I do for selling them for $9 to $10.
But without the hard copy.
Without the hard copy. Right. You just get them to your phone or your mobile device or your Kindle for your PC or your Kindle or your Mobi Pocket or, you know.
That'd be very popular in bars, especially.
And I'm looking for the collegiate crowd, and I've worked, again, back to the restaurants with so many bussers who are now at Chico or Sonoma State or this, and I'll send them free copies, and somebody will be drinking at a kegger, and I'm going to sell it for $1.29, and you just download it, and away you go.
Right. You've had four beers. You don't care about
exactly.
That.
Right. And it's $1.29.
Well, let's go to Tantric Zoo, which – tell us about the title.
The title. It takes place in a tantric sex weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And I played with titles in this, and I just like the title Tantric Zoo. Because it is a menagerie, I love ensemble casts. High Stakes is an ensemble cast. Tantric Zoo is an ensemble cast. The book that I'm writing right now, Events, is a smaller ensemble cast. But I just like the multiple points of view, and you have more victims, and you have more suspects. So,
well, it's, you know, that closed island kind of idea.
Exactly.
Of the classic mysteries.
I describe Tantric Zoo as 10 Little Indians meets the Harrod Experiment.
Right. So. Well, for those of the old.
Exactly. And anybody
that.
Who nods, I go, okay.
Oh, yeah. I remember that. I'd like you to read a little bit from me for us. And I think it'll give everybody a flavor. It'll introduce the major characters and also the setting, which is critical to this.
This is Chapter 2, and it's called Tantricity Hill Retreat. On Friday morning, March 20th, 1987, two couples arrive simultaneously at the Tantricity Hill Retreat. This coincident arrival is a feat which is almost impossible to accomplish. Tantricity Hill, situated on the cusp between northern Sonoma and southern Mendocino counties, is at the end of a rutted and dusty two-track that twisted and bumped through vineyards, orchards, sheep pastures, oak woodlands, and finally, a gated single-lane bridge. Couples who journeyed to Tantricity Hill for their three-day sex seminar flew into SFO or Oakland International, then perambulated by car northward to Cloverdale, 3 hours depending upon traffic, then west on US 128 through the Redwoods to Mountain House Road, and eventually the rustic dirt road leading to the camp. There was no sign announcing Tantricity Hill's existence, and most soon-to-be tantric sex students missed the side road and drove to Hopland, where the postman or the bartender at Gunther's Do Drop In would offer precise directions, then snicker at the perverts as they exited, wondering and secretly envious about exactly what transpired on top of that there hill, and how much it might cost. So, for the first time in the retreat's 7-year history, Apple and Altair could perform their solemn and silly indoctrination ceremony for two couples at once. "Welcome," said Altair as he draped leis around the guest's neck. The leis were shipped to Tantricity Hill once a month by a gay couple from Kauai who had attended the retreat nearly 4 years ago. The wreaths were kept in a freezer, then thawed gently in a refrigerator until draped around the necks of newly arrived guests. "Welcome, welcome," said Apple. The four campers were embraced and kissed by Apple and Altair. The foursome stood, freshly garlanded in the cozy spring sunshine. A slight morning breeze, mildly infused with skunk, ruffled the leis and Altair and Apple's flowing saffron robes. "Welcome," said Altair. "Welcome, welcome," repeated Apple. She lit four sticks of sandalwood and handed one stick to each of Tantricity Hill's initiates, bowing. "Follow us, please." The guests had been warned that only a purse for the women and a shaving kit for the men were allowed into the compound. One couple swung their accessory sacks like circa 1920s flappers' beaded bags. The others clutched theirs like life preservers. "We ask," said Altair, "that you bring no suitcases. The first service we bestow upon you is to enter our retreat, our home, with no baggage." "Please follow us," said Apple. The couples followed, again, the one duo eager, the other apprehensive. "This," said Altair with a theatrical encompassing gesture to his left, "is the sacred pool, Lake Pomo." It is where, on the morrow, we shall all partake of the water ritual. Lake Poma was, in actual fact, a kidney-shaped stucco swimming pool fed by a warm underground spring that the land's original tenants, the Pomo Indians, truly deemed sacred. But the Pomos were long gone, relocated to the dusty, wind-blown Stewart Reservation east of Carson City, Nevada. The Pomos' sacred ancestral valley was now an appellation in California's wine industry.
Okay. Well, what happens shortly thereafter is another couple arrives.
Another couple arrives.
In a fancy Mercedes.
Yep.
And then we've got the whole cast of characters.
You've got the whole cast of characters, all eight of them.
Right. And essentially, the head of this, Altair, right, has decided after a variety of different other, activities, mm-hmm, that he's going to make they get $1,500 per couple.
Right.
So, you're getting $4,500 every weekend.
Right.
Significant amount of income, mm-hmm, especially 1987.
No overhead.
No overhead.
No clothes.
Right. And clothing optional throughout, yeah. Although there are people, as you mentioned, people have different feelings about all this. Some are very, open and enjoy the sunshine, and others want to stay covered up as long as they can. Is this based on anything specific that you recall from 1987? Parts of it, especially the water ritual, sound like something that goes on right now in Harbin Hot Springs.
Not really. Nothing that I've ever personally experienced. Sunbathing for me is like putting a fork in the microwave. I burn, I peel, and then I go to the dermatologist for a biopsy. Mm. So I'm not a sun worshiper. I stay out of it as much as I can. But again, I'm aware that people are disrobing all over the place and jumping in pools and such like that. And a lot of it is a comic interpretation of the hero with a thousand faces, the baptism that is part of every religious institution ever, mm-hmm, made. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Well, there's one structure that's completely dark inside that they carefully do not call womb-like.
They call it the umphalos.
Right.
Yes.
There's a name for every one of the buildings.
There is.
Named after parts of where the founders used to live.
Yeah, in San Francisco. Right. And I forget what I used to call the Umphalos, but it was the Cow Palace, probably.
Has that idea. I have that idea of that shape.
Yeah.
The immensity of it. And essentially, these couples have come to this for their own personal needs.
They have. The one couple, as you mentioned, who are reticent to unrobe, she is frigid, and she read this is a sex camp, and she's expecting something therapeutic. They're from Terre Haute, Indiana, mm-hmm, and they traveled the longest distance for the best reason, and she wants something therapeutic to cure her problem. She loves her husband very much, and she wants to have children, and it is way too California woo-woo for her.
Right.
The older lady.
Well, let's talk a little bit. Let's not leave her yet.
Oh,
she's
sure
had a miscarriage.
Yes.
So there's a back history to her. She also likes to quote Russian literature for every event, like I do movies.
Precisely, yeah. She is based on a waitress that I used to work with who spoke Russian perfectly. Mm-hmm. And she was from Virginia Beach, Virginia, and there's no reason for her to speak Russian except she was raised by her Russian grandma. And she'd speak to customers in perfect Russian. And, they'd love her and she loved them.
There's so much in this book. You can, if you know Sonoma and Mendocino counties,
right,
you can see the dusty roads you're going on and some of the buildings that you've talked about. And
right,
then you go down to the peninsula to Burlingame and down to Petaluma for in the future, I mean, the now,
right,
because we jump, to now.
20 years, yeah.
There's this huge building that looks like it came out of the space age.
Oh, yeah, the Pro Football Hall of Fame, which is based on the modern mega churches, and Altair built his own mega church. And basically, Altair is a guy who works very hard to not have to work for a living. He just comes up with these schemes. It would be easier for him to get a job and pay taxes, I think. But he just can't.
I don't know that that's actually true. But he likes the idea in his head that he has freedom. Although
yeah, that's true.
Takes
yeah.
every minute of his time.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
So the other couples, do you want to introduce us to them?
Sure. We have. Can't remember their names.
Just talk about them generically.
Okay. A recently widowed lady in her mid-50s. From San Diego, has hooked up with a gigolo, and she is out for what she terms a weekend of revenge. She wants to go home and tell all her 50-year-old friends that she spent the weekend with a 25-year-old studly ex-college football player. And she is very happy, and she is very self-possessed, and she's seen enough of life to realize that Altair is full of it, and but she's having fun, and she paid the admission fee, and she signed up, and she's having fun. And the other couple are movie stars, Deborah and Devin, and they are pretty much your generic movie stars. They live in their little glass castle, and everybody attends to every need that they might have or anybody thinks that they might have.
Well, let's go back a little bit. You introduce
Please.
Her by saying she has disrobed in every movie she's ever made.
Right, Deborah, yeah.
She's very proud of her body.
She's very proud of her body, yeah. And she has done Smokers, which are 8mm or Super 8, 7
But that's
minute,
when she was underage.
When she was underage. And her husband, who's very much a Svengali, taking care of her career, has purchased all the smokers that he can and destroyed them because he wants to make her a legitimate movie star.
Right.
So she realizes that her body is her currency, and she gets exactly what she wants.
Yeah, I sort of saw a Bo Derek kind of
exactly,
idea
precisely,
there.
Yeah. Yeah. With John Carpenter, was it? Or?
No, no. What was his name? Isn't that awful? Forgotten
John,
him.
John Derek.
John Derek.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The director
right.
slash Svengali.
Right, exactly. Right. Yeah, yeah, very much so, Bo Derek. Yeah.
So you know, it's funny the Studley character, the gigolo.
Right.
I kept hearing
Blake.
I don't know if you remember ever seeing The Emperor's New Clothes, the Disney film, and Patrick Warburton plays this
kind of
big muscle, dense character.
Uh-huh.
And I swore I heard his voice
really?
Throughout this.
Well, that's a great voice to hear. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah Blake.
So we have the Hollywood couple. We have the couple from Terre Haute. We
right.
have the couple who are a paid couple,
right.
Escort and the yes. lady.
Right.
And then the two,
Apple and Altair.
Tell us a little bit more about Apple, because she becomes very important as the book goes on.
Yeah, Apple really is the bridge between part one and 20 years later, part two. She is from, again, a place that I spent summers at when I was a kid, Homedale, Idaho, which is just east of Boise, and it's a farming community. And her real name is Apple, and Apple Abramowitz, and she is a small-town girl, and she has purposely done everything in her life to leave her farm upbringing behind.
Mm-hmm. And has she been successful?
She has been successful on both levels. She has left every vestige of being a farm girl from southern Idaho behind, and she has had fun and found fulfillment doing it. She's a very self-contained character, and she is a staunch vegetarian, and she is the cook.
Based on a
traumatic experience, which
right.
which is kind of personal, too. I got hit by a truck when I was on a bicycle in Homedale, Nevada, and had a compound fracture, much like. Although my drunk mother wasn't driving the truck, as in the book, Apple gets run down by her poor mom. So
yeah. And then sees meat in a whole different way.
Yes, she does. She realizes, seeing the bone jutting from her arm and blood dripping from her elbow, that she is meat, and meat is her, and she never eats meat again, and she's a wonderful vegetarian chef. And at the Tantric Zoo, Tantricity Hill, all the meals are vegetarian. Mm-hmm. And she goes
some
on
a little bit infused with herbs and
yeah,
special
there's,
mushrooms.
Yeah, there's a few mushrooms, a little mushroom adventure to, let's say, ease the inhibitions on day two.
Right.
So a lovely little hippie omelet is whipped up.
And the sheriff, the Mendocino County Sheriff, is Dana Thorvald.
Dana Thorvald, yes.
And she has is really really has some mixed feelings about this place.
She does. She admits in part two that she is secretly envious of Apple because they're the same age, and she's working as a Mendocino County Sheriff, chasing pot growers and busting up teenage keggers, and Apple has found a way to have sex for a living, and she enjoys it. So part of Dana's responsibility is keeping two types of people away from the Tantric Zoo. Number one, gawkers who just want to see the activity, and number two, Christian soldiers who want to sing and pray and stop the activity.
Right.
So.
And the gawkers, she finds some teenage boys out there with binoculars.
Yeah. The teenage boys are in the plum orchard, and they know that three new sets of breasts arrive every Friday, and they're up there passing the binoculars, and they share quite well, actually. They get along very nicely, the boys.
But they come from a family that takes a lot of time and attention from the sheriff.
Yes. They are the Morton family, and Mr. Morton had one child and then divorced his wife and married his younger brother's wife. So he's Uncle Daddy to three of his kids and Daddy Daddy to one of his kids. And they are hellions, and they're just lovable, wonderful redneck family with a rusting Pontiac in their front yard. Yeah.
Right.
So.
Got to have the car in the
absolutely
front yard, up on blocks.
Exactly.
Because some days can be worth something.
That's right.
Okay, so Dana Thorvald is also one of the characters that carries forward because we'll flash forward.
Right.
20 years.
20 years.
And she's called in because a body is discovered on some land by an excavation digger.
Right.
That scoops the dirt out. What is that called?
Backhoe.
Backhoe. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And so what do they find?
20 years later.
And who are they going to call?
Who are they going to call? They're going to call Bud. 20 years later, the property, the land that was Tantricity Hill Retreat, the sex retreat, the Tantric Zoo, has reverted to the Pomos. And they're breaking ground for a new casino. And they find a body. So they call Bud Warhol. And Bud Warhol owns the local pub/bar/bar and grill in Hopland, California, and he's an on-call forensic anthropologist. I worked with a guy named Damon who did this precise, exact job. I worked at the original Girl in the Fig in Glen Ellen, and Damon was an anthropology, had his master's in anthropology. And he was on call with the California State Police. And when they'd find a body or some bones, they'd call Damon or a person like him, and he'd go out and ascertain whether they were, first of all, human or animal, and then how old, and whether it was a scene of a crime or just a random dead body, or perhaps it was interred a cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
So they would proceed thusly after
getting, or Native American remains.
Or a Native, yeah, just scattered here and there. And of course, a trained forensic anthropologist can look at the cheekbones and the hip girdles and determine race and sex just like that. So,
which he does. He immediately determines the race and the sex of the
absolutely
person who's in this painted, splattered tarp.
Right, yeah. And Bud takes great delight in a particular trick that he does. The foreman is very mad at Bud for stopping work because he's got these guys leaning on their shovels and they're still on the clock. And there is calcium leaches from the bones at a given rate. And there is a trick that forensic anthropologists use is they will pick up a skull and they will lick it. And if your
they clean it off first.
They clean it off first with a little handy wipe. And then you lick it. And if your tongue adheres.
From KFC, as I remember.
From Kentucky Fried Chicken, yeah. And the foreman actually thought that it was a condom that he pulled out at first, but it was just a little KFC moist towelette. So Bud cleans off a portion of the skull, holds it up much like Hamlet looking at Yorick's skull, and licks it. And his tongue adheres to it, which means that there is calcium remaining in the matrix of bone, which means that the remains are less than 25 to 30 years old, which means that it's a crime scene.
Now, being wrapped in this tarp, would that have slowed down the calcium dissipation?
Not really.
You become an expert, I assume.
Yeah. You have to do your homework because there's always someone who's an expert in something. So you do your homework. And one of my summer jobs when I was in college was doing percolation tests, you know. So you drill a hole, then you pour water in it and measure how quick it perks. Yeah, exactly. And there's a lot of variation. So 20, 25 years is I'm the science is sound on this. So,
okay.
Yeah.
I'll take your word.
Thank you.
we'll check it out with CSI.
Oh, please do. Yeah.
Okay. So we've got a body. It's 20, 25 years old. How does he stumble on the idea that this might have been the site of the future, past in the tantric sex retreat?
It is totally by accident because Dana arrives at the scene and she is, it's 2008 now, and she is a Mendocino County sheriff who's looking at retirement now as she was a rookie in her fifth year in the first part of the book. So they take a walk. And she says, that's where this building used to be when it was a tantric this, and that's when this building, when it was. And he is a forensic anthropologist for a reason. He loves what he does.
Mm-hmm.
Because as he quotes Voltaire later in the book, to the dead we owe only the truth.
Right.
So he wants to know who it is, whether they have family. So it's really a very quiet mission that he undertakes every time he unearths a body. So they're talking, and the name of Altair comes up. And Bud is not hooked into popular culture.
No TV, no.
He watches old movies that he knows he likes on DVD and VHS, and he doesn't care, you know, and he's old enough that he's seen it all before. The Afghanistan war is kind of a replay, tragically, again, of Vietnam. And as he says, the 49ers are just good enough to break your heart every year. And the Giants are still, although they didn't last year, still losing to the Dodgers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So he takes it as a personal mission to find this. And what sets him on the trail that there may be foul play is Altair lies to him about the number of people who attended the camp. And then his interest is just piqued because he's been lied to, and he takes that personally too.
Right.
And Altair's such a pompous fool. Anybody would love to take him down, although he does have his nice.
Okay, well, I'm going to go back to the part of the book that is sure to get the reader's attention. Essentially, every one of the living spaces comes equipped with its own pillow book of the Kama Sutra.
Right, exactly.
And surprise, surprise, the couples often reference that.
Absolutely.
And try out new ideas.
Cliff notes.
That's right. Annotated. Yeah. And you go through several get-togethers of, you know, a couple.
Right.
Where we go from, I don't know, I'm trying to remember the name of it, splitting the bamboo
right.
to
the mouse,
the pair of tongs,
right.
et cetera, et cetera. And people will have to look that up to find out. Because there are variations on the Kama Sutra. Sometimes the titles of the positions change.
Right.
You are listening to Word by Word Conversations with the Writers, where tonight's conversation is with the award-winning mystery novelist Rob Loughran and his newest novel, Tantric Zoo, where forensic anthropologist Bud Warhol's investigation of a body buried for over 20 years leads back to a 1987 couples retreat when a weekend of hedonistic sensuality ends in a death and a secret burial that has haunted the campers ever since. And we're going to go right back to the idea of writing parts of acting out the Kama Sutra and what a writer's critique group gives us advice about that.
Yeah, the writer's critique group, because I start the book off immediately into this ensemble cast of characters. Think Cheers. You know, the main character is the one that you identify with. You know, if you're a smart aleck waitress, you love Carla, you know. So anyway, they thought that it was a mainstream comic / literary novel. They didn't realize it was a mystery novel. So I had to go back and start with the body.
Ah.
Yes.
So that's the preface now.
Yeah, that is the preface. So that undeniably, you know that you're picking up a murder mystery. There's murder afoot. It's going to be solved. You know, that's the contract with the reader. It's going to be solved fairly by the time you finish the book. About the sex scenes, and again, I mentioned Joseph Campbell earlier. I remember a lecture that I attended of Joseph Campbell's decades ago where he was talking about the muses in India.
Mm-hmm.
And the muse that governs comedy in India also governs pornography, which seemed to fit for me. So I write the sex scenes as physical comedy. And to answer,
we have to stop as you're reading them and think about things.
The actual logistics
read.
So I had to. It's not like I did a storyboard or anything, but you have to make sure that if they.
So you have women in this critique group.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, it was all women. I was the only man.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, and so
they enjoyed the scenes. Yeah. Yeah. And
you knew you were on the right track.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, that's good. So, in fact, one of the things I know you've got a very plain, pre-edition cover on here, but I was thinking about that preface.
Right.
I'm wondering if you shouldn't just put on the front that this is a Bud Warhol mystery.
Yes.
And put that back in the timeline where it would have naturally occurred. That's just a question as a reader.
Started where you
started reading.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I think what it does is it stands on its own. You don't need, in other words, it would be nice to have that as a surprise almost, because not where you think it's going.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there again, it depends on how you want to sell the book.
I mean, right. I would like to sell it. My goal for this book is to sell enough to pay for the copies that I give away.
That works.
Yeah.
Or find a new publisher.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. So where can we get this?
You can get this on my website, www.roblochranbooks.com.
Spell that for people.
It is Roblochran books.com.
Good.
Yeah. And it's also going to be available. It's going up to Smashwords, so it'll be available on the Sony Reader, Kindle Reader, Android, all the about 7 mobile
different formats
devices. Yeah,
right.
It's a totally different thing with formatting and uploading and such like that. We're doing that now, and that's the new cover will be on the hard copy, the actual copy, as soon as we make it work as a thumbnail for the ebooks.
Well, I have to tell you, I got into this quite quickly, and I was delighted how it followed the mystery rules. You know, you have things happen.
Right.
And just like Agatha Christie, there's more than one death. I should let people know that. It all makes sense. It all works together. What was the most fun to write? What section of this was the part that flowed most easily?
You know, once probably the end, because as Robert Frost said, no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader. So part one.
We don't want to talk and give away the end. So
no, I won't give away the end. But part one, I put a dead body on the ground. I had the people cover it up. I didn't know who killed.
Ah.
I didn't know which character killed the person. So I sat with my fingers.
And it happened in that completely dark building. Everyone
right,
should
exactly.
Know that
it happened
setting.
In the Umphalos. So right. Nobody who was present knew who killed the person either.
And they all have suspicions.
And they all have suspicions, and the suspicions point to his wife, of course, because they're very vociferous.
And they had an argument the night before.
And they are the Hollywood couple, so they had been written up in the tabloids as a very a volcanic relationship. So,
but it could be the gigolo.
It could be the gigolo because there's a little bit of jealousy there, and it
and they kind of go into a new era of sexuality.
Right,
as well.
Exactly. Yeah. They are they become friends. Yeah.
Right, close friends.
Close, very close.
So we have more than one suspect.
We do. And
and Altair and Apple aren't out of that loop either.
No, they're not. And I think that is the benefit as a writer, not knowing who did it, because you have to give everybody – you have to look at everybody equally. If you don't know who did it, you have to hide their tracks, and you have to give everybody equal opportunity so that they're all legitimate possible suspects.
Right.
And I was probably one-third the way into part two before I said, that's the person
who did it.
Right. And then once I figured that out, I went back and immediately killed the most likely person to have done it. So again, from Agatha Christie, you know. And but probably the best part was when Bud figures it out, when somebody says something and he sees dirt on a car, and he solves the mystery because he sees red dirt
from the mountains and rust
and salt rust from a car that purportedly came from San Rafael.
Right.
And he figures it all out, and the reader's not privy to it. You're privy to his actions, but you don't see his thought processes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But and then the hard part, and then the fun part too, was Bud is not an expert at martial arts, and he's certainly not a policeman. He doesn't have a policeman's mentality.
He doesn't even have a cell phone.
He doesn't have a cell phone, and he knows he's in over his head. But he does have a certain insight into human nature. And I think the most satisfying part of writing the entire thing for me was that Bud could apprehend the actual dangerous murderer and still
–
Who's holding a gun on him and still be true to his – he's certainly not nonviolent, but he solves that particular situation, that dangerous puzzle, in a very satisfying and true to his character way.
Right. Yeah. I would agree. I would agree. That's true.
And that was tough.
Now, the other thing that must have been interesting was to create a brand new religion, which is based on a best-selling book.
Yes.
Called God is a Voyeur.
God is a Voyeur. Which Altair wrote the best-selling book, God is a Voyeur.
He's on Larry King and everybody else.
He's on Larry King. Larry King takes a couple kicks to the head from me in this book, and for no particular reason. I've never met the man. I'm sure he's very nice. So Altair invents his own religion, and he gets a whole bunch of people to subscribe to it. And again, Bud is curious because usually cults, they have you give you your car and pay money and all that stuff. And all of Altair's stuff is free except for the, again, 7 to 9 people who pay through the nose for the experience. For a 45-day detox program.
Right.
Yeah.
In Petaluma.
In Petaluma, California. Yeah.
So – did you want to share anything about this religion?
It is as viable as any religion. Richard Jenny, the great comedian, said fighting over religion, having a war over religion, is fighting about who has the best invisible friend. So Altair made up a religion.
My invisible friend can beat your
exactly right. Because you're the heretic and I'm the orthodox. Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, and so he just started a religion because it's a great business opportunity. What do you sell? You sell a concept. How many times can you sell a concept?
And the tax breaks for
that absolutely
are tremendous.
Yeah, and he's making a good living. He has a ex-Marine bodyguard chauffeuring him around Petaluma in his baby blue limousine. And the religion I just kind of made up from Altair's mouth. There's a point as a writer, I don't know how you get there, but you get there where you're writing in character. Mm-hmm. And everything you write
in that character's voice
is in that character's voice, in his intonation. You hear it in your head, and you know when you say something false to the character. I'm not saying when you say something false, because he is full of lies and he is full of it. But there was a point when I got into Altair where his BS was spinning out of me at an alarming rate. So that was fun, and that was his speech, his God is a voyeur speech, came out pretty much first draft, and I am not a first draft writer. I rewrite.
Oh,
absolutely,
rewrite.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to change this entirely. This is based on made up people, composites of people that
exactly
you know that you know, and you're talking. You were telling me that you've started a whole new project, completed a whole new project, which is a screenplay about
right.
Jack and Charmian London.
Jack and Charmian London.
And their trip to the South Sea Islands
exactly.
on the Snark.
On the Snark.
And the title is The
Voyage of the
Voyage
Snark.
Voyage of the Snark. And this is more difficult, I would think, because you have to do a lot of research. You have to make sure that those experts out there who are going to criticize you, won't do that.
Precisely. And I did do a lot of research, and I remember crystalline the moment that this idea for the screenplay came to me. I was reading American Dreamers by Clarice Stass,
mm-hmm.
A beautiful book about Charmian London principally, but you
right.
can't talk about Charmian without talking about Jack. And there was this scene that Clarice is describing in the book where a captain and a lieutenant immediately following Pearl Harbor went up to the beauty cottage and knocked on Charmian's door and said, "We understand that you have maps of the Marquesas Islands." This was absolutely unexplored territory. And she did, because they made it from Hawaii to Tahiti through the Marquesas. And I go, wow, this is the frame that I need.
That's your opening scene in your
That's
screenplay.
The opening scene. And
right.
it creates the frame for Jack London. And as a little kid, I remember riding my bike up that big hill to go visit the Wolf House. And
which still has an eerie charm to it. Yeah, that's a good
absolutely.
Way to put it. Almost religious feeling.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it was very much a pilgrimage, you know. And and particularly with this project, Voyage of the Snark, I dotted my I's and crossed my T's. And I did a lot of research. And I read, Jack London wrote 41 books. I read, skimmed a few of them, but I read the majority of every word that he's ever written. Just so that what I say about his writing.
Well, that was a prodigious task, because he was a consummate 1,000, 1,500 words a day.
Yep.
Chick every morning.
Absolutely, yeah. And I do say a few disparaging things about Jack London, but one thing that I will say about Jack London is I pretty much stole his regimen. That's exactly what I do. I have a calendar on my wall. I have X number of words I write a day, and I put an X on my calendar, or I don't put an X on my calendar. And that is Jack London, and I just stole it from him.
The interesting thing, and I did not know this because I've just read part of your screenplay, because I just got it yesterday, but I didn't know that Jack and Charmian had been declared dead by the newspapers.
Oh, absolutely.
When they were on there.
Yeah, from the leg from San Francisco
to
Hawaii.
They were out of contact.
Absolutely.
Which, of course, in 1907, isn't that unusual.
Right. Yeah, but they were off course. But he was such a grandstander. He announced, the Snark and Jack London will be sailing into Honolulu Harbor 6 days hence. And they were gone, I think, 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, which isn't that.
No, not that bad.
No.
But he was a noteworthy person. He was larger than life. He was George Clooney-esque in his cachet at
that
time.
Well, he was the most popular writer. I mean, absolutely. Everybody knew him.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he was world famous.
From Boy's Life to Ladies' Home Journal.
And Overland Monthly.
Absolutely.
And he was getting $1,000 for a short story when somebody made, what, $1,400 a year?
Yeah.
And just if any locals have not been up to the Wolf House, please go up there and just see his ranch and his acreage and just imagine the money he had.
And his vineyards and his piggery.
Oh, absolutely. And all of them were failures.
Luther Burbank and Heworth, eucalyptus trees and all kinds of.
They imported the eucalyptus and planted them too close together, and the leaves fell, and they spontaneously combusted and burnt down. And
all kinds of fun stuff.
Yeah, he did a lot of things. In
now, when the you start out, and this is a historical question because I love these kinds of things. When the two military men arrive at the door, they're very on guard, I guess I would say, because they see Charmian as a socialist,
right.
a communist,
right.
someone-ist.
A threat.
A threat to them who probably will not offer to help them in their
right.
their quest for maps
Precisely.
And charts.
Analogous to that would be the day after 9/11 going into a mosque to ask a Muslim for help.
Mm-hmm.
Seriously. And they were that on guard is the word. And they were suspicious of her. And she was a registered socialist. Jack had renounced socialism when he started making money. Funny how that works.
Well, I'm not sure it's exactly the same time, but yes.
Yeah.
Because he was – some of his characters in his later works are quite
– fervent about
yes,
it.
Yes,
yeah.
yes.
Yeah, but again, they were works of fiction, so – yeah. But Charmian is just an absolutely fascinating character. She really, really is. In fact, the Jack London that we're talking about today, the mythic Jack London, the writer and sailor on horseback, she did as much or more to create the person we're talking about right now than Jack London's writing merits, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
His writing is...
Although To Light a Fire.
To Light a Fire is the best thing he's ever written.
Yeah.
And John Barleycorn, Alcoholic Memoirs, is an American classic. It really is.
And we could go on.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, White Fang, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, but I like the fact that you talk about the other people who are on the Snark, and I remember pictures of it. I think it's from the book you were mentioning.
Right, American Dreamers,
Yeah. And where they're sitting on this beautiful little sloop.
Yeah.
And you've got these someone who's her servant who's on board.
Right,
too.
Tochigi, a Korean manservant,
right.
who Jack London made Tochigi refer to him as Mr. God. So, which is kind of funny.
Anyway, tell me about the history and where you're going with this, because you've started off on a whole new idea. Is writing a screenplay – well, okay, this is a different question. Writing a screenplay is supposed to be somewhat, quote, easier because it's only 120 pages and it's primarily dialogue.
Right.
But in this case, you had to do so much research.
But when I get on a subject, it's a labor of love. This was originally written in 1994. And – I had to teach myself how to write a screenplay. I knew nothing about formatting.
Just didn't pick up the...
No, I didn't. MLA Writer's Guide, I picked that up finally. But my first draft, single-spaced, was, I think, 320 pages.
Mm.
And another thing that I do as a writer, I never throw anything out. So my current project is a novelization of Voyage of the Snark. So Voyage of the Snark, 1994, this is just when the internet was starting out. Back then, you had to actually write letters to agents and such like that. And again, I entered it in contests. It was shortlisted in just about every contest that I entered it in. It finished second, 1, 12th, 7th. Got a few nibbles. Actually went down to Los Angeles in 97 or 98. Started a small production company. With a bartender that I worked with, and we actually got Dave Klein from Mallrats and Chasing mm-hmm. Amy's as mm-hmm. part of the production company.
Who gives a comment about your first book.
Oh, yeah, he gives me a very nice blurb on my first book.
Right.
And we actually had a couple meetings with Disney and Barry Meldon Productions, and the meetings went great. We just didn't get the money, which, happens quite often. The good thing about that is everything that's in Voyage of the Snark is said and done. It's not like I'm hopping on a disco fad that's, you know, I have like a 6 month or 7 month window to sell it and get the movie made.
Right.
So my new marketing plan is to write the novel and through sales of the novel engender some interest in the screenplay and then sell the screenplay. So
right. So tell me, I'm a third of the way through. So where do they go? Does Jack die? I mean, he gets sick and die in this or not?
You don't see his death.
Has dying of uremic poisoning, which he gets treated, as I remember, in Tahiti.
Right, in Tahiti, yeah. And then he takes a steamer
by
home.
By taking mercury salts or something, which may have been made it worse.
Right, and he was also under medication for syphilis. So he was taking Salvarsan 505, which basically is like chemotherapy. Take as much mercury as you can that doesn't kill you, and it'll take care of the syphilis. So, no, he doesn't die in the screenplay. The last scene is Charmian, him bundles him in blankets, and they're going on the wagon up the hill back to Beauty Ranch. And she says to the audience that, okay, Jack, we're going to get you better, and you're going to dedicate yourself to writing the novel that will make you famous. So the scene ends, and it goes back to the frame with Lieutenant Forbes and Charmian in the barn looking for the charts of the Marquesas.
Which are packed in trunks and boxes.
Exactly. And that barn still exists. You can walk by. It's by the Pratty Winery up there on the property. And anyway, the mystery, there's everything that's ever written, whether it's romance or history, or is a mystery story. The mystery in Voyage of the Snark is how the Wolf House burnt to the ground. That's what you find out.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Because there's various interpretations.
There's various interpretations, and I wrote an article.
The newspaper stories reported at least three different sources.
Exactly. A disgruntled workman.
Right.
Spontaneous combustion. And because it was the Press Democrat, our own Press Democrat, that broke the stories. Yeah. And also insurance fraud by Mr. London, who took out insurance on the house weeks before. And so the possibilities are rife. I accompanied a team of, forensic archaeologists and burn pattern specialists up to the Wolf House in 1997 to write an article called The Mystery of Wolf House.
Mm-hmm.
And they came up with, because it was a single point of origin, they did not think that it was arson.
Because it would have been set at several places.
Exactly. However, a disgruntled wife, I'm not going to give away the mystery, a disgruntled wife or a Mr. Blandine's dream house owner who is in way over his head, who's going to torch it for the insurance money, they're not professional arsonists. Mm-hmm. So a single point of origin, for me, doesn't rule out the fact that either Jack or Charmian could have torched the house.
Hadn't they just put some kind of preservative or something on
the... Yeah, they had just varnished all the cabinets, and this wasn't our modern urethane. This was linseed oil, and it took days to dry.
Right.
And
lots of fumes.
Exactly.
Which, of course, are flammable.
Exactly. And if you piled the rags, they would spontaneously combust. So,
yeah. Don't give it away.
I won't.
Okay. But I've got ideas. Okay, any questions? We got a few minutes here. Anything you want to say to aspiring writers?
Don't quit.
Keep your butt in the chair.
Exactly, and you better love it. And if anybody talks to you about waiting for your muse and don't write until inspiration hits, they're full of it. You have to sit down, like Jack London, for your requisite time every day. I tell people, oh, you write a lot. I do have quite a few books in print. How do you do it? I go, I keep a time card, and I sign in and out. I have a time book on my desk, and I put an X on my calendar. And if I see, I'll tolerate 2 days in a row without an X. 3 days in a row without an X, it's anathema to me. I can't do it. So if you want to be a writer, most people want to have written. You better be in love with the process of writing, or it'll be a pipe dream.
Right.
And that's really good advice.
And you have no problem with the rewrite part of it.
Oh, that's the delight to me, is the polishing It really is.
So and your process, do you wait a specific timeline between?
Yeah, I do. I call putting it in the refrigerator. And it depends on what kind of rewrite, too. If I'm doing a line edit to look for specific punctuation and grammar and errors, I'll put it aside for about 2 weeks. But reworking a scene, and one thing that I've done, one of my writing teachers said, write a scene, then write another one, and take the best from both of them.
Mm-hmm. And sort of like doing two takes of the same.
Exactly. Yeah, and then you overdub and you get the best that way. Right. So, yeah. So just you got to love it and you got to do it for the love of it. And it reminds me of the joke about the engineering major, the finance major, and the creative writing major. The engineering major says, how can we build it? The finance major says, what will it cost? The writer says, would you like fries with that? So.
Exactly.
Back to the restaurants.
Well, I have to tell you, I was very I really enjoyed Tantric Zoo.
Thank you.
It hit me as a mystery. It's very funny. The characters are great. The setting, I swore I was with you in the car driving around to the places because they're so familiar. And even if, of course, you didn't come from here, it would work, which is great in itself. So, again, I want to thank it's Rob Loughran.
Loughran.
And Tantric Zoo. It's available, as he said, online on www.RobLoughran.books. Okay. You have been listening to Word by Word Conversations with Writers, where tonight's conversation has been with the award-winning mystery novelist Rob Loughran and his newest novel, Tantric Zoo, when a body buried for over 20 years leads back to a 1987 couples retreat where a weekend of hedonistic sensuality ends in a death, a secret burial, and a haunted memory that has plagued the campers ever since. We also got a glimpse at Rob's screenplay, The Voyage of the Snark, where we travel with Jack and Charmian London to the South Sea voyage when the newspapers had pronounced the couple lost at sea and presumed dead. Our studio engineer for tonight's program has been Mark Fuller, and I am your host, Gil Manser. We want to invite you to join us on KRCB 91.1 FM in Santa Rosa at 7 p.m. on Wednesday, June 1st. Where our honored guest will be the Time Magazine film critic and documentary filmmaker Richard Schickel, sharing his new book, Conversations with Martin Scorsese. Until then, we wish you and yours a very memorable Memorial Day.